And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, go your way and pour out the vials of wrath of God, of the wrath of God upon the earth. And the first went his way and poured out the vials upon the earth. Let's stop there for a minute. This great voice of deity, only God can command. And this is truly a command. So a great voice. The thought here from the Greek text is, you go, right in here. So it's in the first person singular. You go, you pour out. That's the way that should read. You go, you pour out. And in most of the manuscripts that we have, the phrase your ways are not in that, in the manuscripts. So actually that shouldn't be in it. It's a command for these seven messengers to go and pour. Now, they have had God's wrath, and we've had different views of how his wrath is to be poured out. One thing we want to mention before we go any further, and I should have mentioned it first, this is a vision. And always keep that in mind as you read this. This is a vision. Visions doesn't have realities. Visions don't necessarily are not necessarily literal. And so as we look at this, let's keep in mind that this is a vision. And in this vision, John saw the wrath of God in bowls. Now that doesn't mean they were in literal bowls, but he saw them in bowls. Now the thought that we have in bowls is the easy way or the quick way of pouring out. You can pour out of a bowl easier than you can anything else. And so earlier we had the seven seals, and in that we had the general view of troublous time. The seven seals begin at just a little earlier time than what we have here, as we'll see further. Then we had seven trumpets in chapters 8 and 9. And the trumpets speak of the alarming description of these years of tribulation. And so here the bowls speak of the suddenness of emptying out all of God's wrath upon the earth. And all three of these seven, speak of wrath. They're just seen in different views in different ways. Just like if a television camera would go to a house on fire and one was on four different sides, they get four different views of the same fire. So we have the tribulation times with different ways and means in which these tribulation, or God's wrath, I should say, is being poured out upon the earth. And so this takes us down. Now all of these is simply a description of Daniel 9:27. In fact, our revelation from chapter 4 on is an epitome of Daniel 9:27. This is what we're talking about. We might notice in verse 17, also in chapter 15, 1, and I'm not going to turn to that, but in verse 17, notice how that verse ends, with the fact it is done, or it is finished, which takes us down, you see, to the latter part of this. All of this that we see here is the wrath of God being poured out suddenly upon the earth. Verse 2, and the first went and poured out his big bowl upon the earth, and there were noisome and grievous sores upon men, which had the mark of the beast, and upon them which worshipped his image. So here the first one poured out his big bowl upon the earth. A good rendering of that could be land or ground. It's a Greek word ga, used there. It simply has to do with the dirt, the earth in itself. Now, this is what Adam was made from, isn't it? From the dust of the earth. And so the Adam nature needs to die. It needs wrath of God. The wrath of God was poured out at Calvary upon the Adam nature as he took upon himself the headship of Adam, as Christ took upon himself the headship of Adam, I should say, bore the wrath of God on the whole earth. Another thought that we have when we talk about the earth is a contrast of heaven. And in Colossians 3, verse 2, and this, all we're talking about here in this verse is how heaven and earth is contrast against the Greek word urane and ge. Just a contrasting word. Go ahead.
Set your affection on things above, not on things on the earth.
See? So here's a contrast. Above things, below things. above things, earthly things, heaven and earth. So this is definitely earthly. Another thought we have along this line too is the promises of Abraham. The earthly promises were as the sands of the seas. The heavenly promises of Abraham were as the stars of the heaven. But here we have the earthly, and the Jews are the earthly promises of Abraham. Therefore, many times in prophetic language, the earth speaks of Jewish nation, or the Jewish nation of Israel. Also, earth speaks of weakness. And many times we have this thought throughout the scriptures, the outward weakness of man. And so all of this is going to pour out. I feel that this will be centered around Jerusalem, though. And then we, for the word noisome and grievous sores, there's two Greek words used for that. There's the Greek word kakos, which is an inward evil or inward badness. Then the Greek word poneros is outward badness. And these two words are used. The word kakos is used for noisome, but it's in the neuter gender. In fact, both of these are in the neuter gender. But here we have inward and outward sore that men will have. And the word sores here is an interesting word too, because it has a thought of afflicted wounds that are ulcerated. And they have the thought of stinking sores, a cancerous sore. Many thoughts that we have in there. So this is what is going to be sent down out of the hand of God on the earth. And notice then who is going to receive them. Men who had the mark of the beast upon them which worshipped his image. Now this don't only tell us who, but it also tells us when this bowl is going to be poured out, don't it? Because the mark of the beast isn't going to be offered until approximately the middle of the 7 years of tribulation. He's going to die, and he's going to go in the grave and raise from the grave before the image is set up. And because we read in the 13th chapter that is the basis of setting up the image, wasn't it? The fact that he died and rose from the grave. So we can see the time here that this bowl will be poured out. It'll be approximately the middle of the week. Then the second bowl in verse 3 is poured out upon the sea, and it became as blood of a dead man, and every soul died in the sea. Getting back to this verse 2, notice the singular of grievous sore, not plural, not sores, but one sore for all of these people. And I thought about this for a long time one time. I wonder why that's in the singular rather than plural, because we have a lot of people. Well, the thought here, I believe, is the fact that each one will have the same sore, the same wound. Now, Jesus was wounded for our transgression. They missed this wound, therefore they're going to be wounded. And it, only theirs is going to be exceedingly bad. Not worse than Jesus bore, of course, but exceedingly bad wound. But it's just one. We have a similar thought in verse 3. The sea became as blood of a dead man. And that's an interesting thought, I feel. Now, let's look back over this before we look at it, because the sea in Scripture, and remember this is a vision, is not a literal sea as we know a sea. If it were, there wouldn't be living soul that in the sea. You see, men have a soul. Animals don't have a soul. Fish don't have soul. We know that they're not talking about fish or literal things that would be in the sea. So when the subject here is symbolic, then the rest of the things around it must be symbolic also. So here we have, and as John looked at this, I could just see him in a vision seeing a sea of blood. And not any particular sea, just a sea of blood. And again, we notice the singular of one dead man. And this speaks of the human race. This is, again, in the neuter gender. There's only one man of the old creation, and that's Adam. And in Adam, all sin, all falls short of the glory of God. So man, out of man comes death, without the shedding of blood. Leviticus 17, is that right? Or 7? Anyway, the life of the flesh is in the blood. You can look it up. So this is simply life of men is gone. And it's like an ocean, a sea of blood. How much blood? A lot of blood. And every soul died in a sea of blood. Then verse 4, the third angel poured out his bowl of wrath upon the waters and fountains of water, the rivers and fountains of water, and they became blood. We have a picture of this in the 10th chapter, I believe it is, of Exodus, when Moses, God poured out his wrath upon Egypt. But rivers and fountains, let's think about that for a minute. They speak of that which is refreshing, that which is needed for life. Man can't live without water. And so also spiritually, man can't live without spiritual blessings. Jesus said, whosoever eateth of me and drinketh of my blood shall never die. Then he one day of the great day of the feast, he stood up and cried out, whosoever drinketh of me shall out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. This is blessing. This is spiritual blessing. But here at this time, the whole church is gone. And there isn't any blessing from God except a little that when people get saved. And as we noticed last couple of weeks, God pours out wrath and then he has a time of comfort and an opportunity again to receive the Lord. But I think here we see false religion. That should bring comfort and blessing to people, but hasn't over the years. We might in this same verse, well, verse 5 rather, and I heard an angel of the water say, thou art righteous, O Lord, which art, was, shall be, because thou hast judged thus. Now we compare the righteousness of God with the righteousness of falsity or false religion. Of course, there isn't any righteousness there at all. So this is what God's wrath is being poured out upon. Now, in verse 6, we have proof that this is people rather than a literal river or a little fountain. God was blessed because thou hast judged us. Verse 6, they have shed blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy. Now see, the rivers and fountains didn't shed the blood of saints and prophets, did they? It was people that shed the blood of saints and prophets. So we're talking, we're rivers and fountains, we're literally talking about people that should be a blessing, but they weren't. They should be a spiritual help to the world. And it's these that God is going to judge at this time. All right, let's go on down the fourth bowl then. See, is anything I'm missing in there? All right, verse 7, and I heard another out of the altar say, even so, Lord God Almighty, true and righteous are thy judgments. Seems like this is kind of a parenthetical verse, a verse of comfort, a verse of agreement with God. They agree with God, even though the whole world has disagreed with God. There's always some that's agreeing with him. And that's what we want to do in it, agree with God. Verse 8, we had the fourth angel, messenger, pour out his big bowl upon the sun, and power was given to him to scorch men with fire. Such a terrible, terrible way to be judged. In, I think it's a fourth trumpet, and I was trying to think where it is. It didn't come to my mind right now. But anyway, we have, this is equal to the fourth trumpet, I believe. And as pour out upon the sun, power was given to him. To the angel, the messenger, power was given to him to scorch men with fire by using the sun in different ways. And there's a lot of thoughts that we could inject in there of how the sun could be used to scorch men. We hear a lot today about the ozones or the filters up there that's getting so thin that they're not filtering the sun. And when I was young, well, you used to be able to get a sunburn that wasn't all that dangerous. Now, they tell me that it's extremely dangerous to get a sunburn. But how much greater would it be in judgment? Now, some commentaries believe that God's going to just take that filter away. Some people think that God's going to bring the sun closer to the earth because there has been talk about it getting closer all the time. I can't speculate. I don't know how this is going to be. I do know that this is a fact and it's going to happen, that men will be scorched with fire. And the purpose of the sun wasn't for that to begin with. God gave the sun as a light, didn't he? To lighten men, not scorch men, but to help men. Give the moon to give light by night and the sun by day. But men has rejected the things of God and the creation of God. They've done everything they can to try to disprove God and, well, as a creator. So I feel that God is going to use creation to pour his wrath out upon the creature that he's created on earth. And men were scorched, verse 9, with great heat, and blasphemed the name of God, which hath power over these plagues, and they repented not to give him glory. So, great wrath. I was reading here a while back about the sun and the power of the sun, and we read here that power was given to use the sun. 93 million miles in diameter. It don't even come close to what the earth is. I looked this up in the dictionary just this morning before I left, and it's 332,000 times of the earth. So we're talking about God's creation, and God is going to use brightness of the sun. Now, Jesus is our brightness, isn't he? And we don't have to worry about getting sunburned. Paul, in his testimony in Acts, the 26th chapter in it of Acts, he said that when he saw Jesus, he was above the brightness of the sun, above it. And yet he wasn't hurt. His eyes was blinded for a while for a purpose, but he wasn't scorched. And then in the first chapter of Revelation, we have a thought there along. Alan, read that for me. Yeah, I think it's verse 6.
First chapter.
Revelation 1:16, I think it is. Jesus is called the brightness of the sun. Isn't it? Verse 6?
6.
6. All right. I knew it was one of the two. Is that it? 16. I knew it was either 6 or 16, but I couldn't remember.
And he had in his right hand 7 stars. And out of his mouth went a sharp two-edged sword, and his countenance was as the sun shineth in his strength.
Right, Jack Fellers, you read James 1:10-11 is an interesting verse on that. How that Jesus is called the brightness of the sun and its strength.
But the rich in that he was made low, because as a flower of the grass he shall pass away. For the sun is no sooner risen with a burning heat, but it withereth the grass. And its flower falleth, and the grace of the fashion hath perished. So also shall the rich man fade away in his ways.
And Peter tells us that all flesh is grass. The Psalms tells us the same thing. And so we're talking about the old creation, aren't we? And how fragile it is, and it just doesn't take much to burn it up. Anyway, what we're talking about is God's wrath being poured out upon the earth to scorch men, and men are going to feel, but are they going to turn to God? No, not in any way, will they? They've been blaspheming him too many years, haven't they? The old creation has to be put to death. They'll not repent and not give him glory. All right, verse 10, we have the fifth big bowl of wrath. Upon the seat of the beast, and his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongue for pain. Seat, or the throne is a better rendering of that, should be the throne of the beast. We saw this same beast in the book of Daniel when we studied Daniel. This is the same as the feet, the toes of the image of Daniel 2 that come off the feet. Now we know the legs and the feet represent the Roman Empire, and the toes of this represent the revival of the Roman Empire. And we studied that before. So, because of this, we feel that the seat of the Antichrist will be in Rome. And this is also will be the center of religion. And we'll see that probably in the 17th and 18th chapter some. Now, the seat of the false prophet, no doubt, will be in Jerusalem, because the image of the Antichrist will be set up in the holy place. Matthew 24, give us light on this. So it'll be poured out upon the throne of the beast, seat. And his kingdom was full of darkness. Now there's a difference between a throne and a kingdom. The throne is the center of the reign. The kingdom has to do with what he reigns over. And so all the kingdom experienced this wrath that's poured out. Full of darkness. Satan is full of darkness to begin with. So before this, the only light that was there was from God, wasn't it? Because there's no light in Satan. He's always darkness. We've been translated from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of the Son of His love, Colossians 1:13, I believe it is. And so now all of God's, everything of God has been taken away. No light whatsoever. Now, Egypt again had an experience of this, didn't they? Do we read there in Exodus that the darkness was so great that it could be felt? I've never been in that much darkness, feel it. But I tell you, there's more fear to darkness than any one thing to be afraid of for the old creation. I don't know whether you've ever walked into a dark room and with a great fear. Darkness, you see, is an act of not knowing. You know, it's like death. If we know where we're going, we're not entering into darkness, are we? We're entering the light. But if you don't know where you're going, then you have a fear of death. And so many things that gives us, the darkness brings upon us. But none of the darkness of Egypt can compare with this darkness. Even though it was so bad it could be felt, this is much worse, because this fear and whatever come over them caused them to gnaw their tongues with pain. How great this is. How great pain this is. We read in the 8th chapter of Matthew, Evelyn, look up Matthew 8, I think it's verse 12. So here's a comparative thing, isn't it? Outer darkness. How dark is outer darkness? I guess nobody can answer that question, can they? But it's great, terrible. Maxine, Matthew 22:13, and Ronnie, look up Matthew 25:30, and all these have to do with the pangs of darkness and how great it is. Oh, all right, Joe, Matthew 25:30. Maxine, 25:30. Now again, I say I don't know where outer darkness is. Some commentaries seem to think it's a black hole in space. I have no idea. Again, I refuse to speculate on God's things. All right, the fifth angel in verse 10. See, did we talk about that? No, we didn't talk about verse 9, did we? Men were scorched with the heat, and they blasphemed God. Yeah, well, I talked about that. Didn't we? Notice these are called plagues in verse 9. Terrible plague poured out upon the fifth angel, poured out of his bowl. It's 11. They blasphemed the name, blasphemed the God of heaven, because they're pained and sore and repented not of their deeds. All right, verse 12, the sixth angel poured out his big bowl upon the river Euphrates, and the waters and the water thereof was dried up, and the way of the king, in order that, we might say, the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. The sixth bowl poured out upon the river Euphrates, preparing a way for kings to come down into the valley of Jehoshaphat, as we'll read a little later on. In the ninth chapter, Jack Davis 9, Revelation 9, and it told him to loose the spirit. That's what I want. Did I give you the wrong verse? 14. 15. Loose those angels. Yeah. So you see, these have been held back. Now, the Euphrates River isn't that big a river to stop an army, is it? And we talked about that when we were in chapter 9. So the thought here is the power of God that is holding back these armies until His time. God does have a special time for all things. Ecclesiastes 3. He has a time for all things. He had a time for Jesus to be born. He had a time for Jesus to die. And He has a time for those armies to come down into this valley. So they've been held back, and the armies of the east might be prepared. I say again, the word that should be translated in order that the way. The word east comes from a series of Greek words that should be translated the rising of the sun. The word the rising of the sun. Now there'll be many nations come into this valley. Not just Assyria or those of north, but God's going to bring all nations. We read in the third chapter of Joel. We'll read that pretty soon. Down into this valley. Now, the nations of the east, and you think a lot about that, towards the rising of the sun. The nations that are in that direction, which is easier to come down from the north than it is from the east. It's, I don't know how many was seen pictures of the, what they call it, that desert invasion, but it's very difficult even for our equipment to go through all that sand, especially if they have an Arabia. It'd be easier to come through Iraq than it would be to come through the Arabian desert. I had another thought, too, along this line was, you know, during World War II, Japan had their symbol was the rising of the sun. These are just some thoughts. I'm not saying, like again, I say I'm not speculating. But these armies will come down. These have all been held back by the power of God. We can see God manipulating nations in the last few years and getting them prepared for this time. Now, the water's dried up. There's no more hindrance at this time. And so the nations can come down. The condition of these nations is in verse 13 and 14. And I saw three unclean spirit-like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet. Now these aren't literal frogs again, but remember this is a vision, and John sees frogs. Men don't see frogs. They see something nice and hopeful, you know, in all this. And even their hate over Israel would not see these frogs at all. So John saw them like frogs, but they're really evil spirits. And in verse 14, we tell what they are. They are the spirits of demons, working miracles, and which go forth into the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them into battle against that great day God. This is God's final judgment. Brings us all the way down to the end, down to verse 16. But we find that the nations will be stirred up by satanic spirits, satanic beings. Earlier we saw when the beast died and went into a pit, came out of the pit. When he came out of the pit, locusts came out with him. And we've already looked into all of this, but these, again, are evil spirits that came out. They've been waiting for this day of judgment, bound, waiting for this time. And so the whole world will be stirred, and hatred will be stirred up by satanic forces. And they'll be ready to go. They used to say about horses chomping at the bits, ready to go. And it's just waiting for God's timing to release them. Then all that come forth into the kings of the earth and the whole of the whole world. And as we had before, all nations will be brought down into this terrible place where God is going to judge all these nations. Now, the river Euphrates, let's think about this again for a minute, is God's northern boundary for Israel. God's promise to Abraham were that his seed would be from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates. And as I mentioned before, that's not the river Nile. That's the river of Egypt, which is in the Sinai. It's in the Sinai Desert, in the wilderness of Sin, is where the river of Egypt is. So this will be, as that's in Genesis 15, I believe it is, where that is. But these kings of the east will come forth. Earlene, read for me Isaiah 8, 6 and 7. And notice the comparison here of how the overflow of the Euphrates River was used concerning the Assyrians. And remember that Isaiah had a partial fulfillment, but there's still a greater fulfillment out of the book of Isaiah that will be fulfilled in the last days. Read that for me. Isaiah 8, 6 and 7. See, because they rejected the sweet waters, the pleasant waters of Shiloh. See, peaceful waters. That's the Lord Jesus Christ. They rejected him. They're going to, well, back in Isaiah's time, of course, they was rejecting the offer of God and the blessings of God and accepted idolatry and other things. Well, God sent Assyria down, didn't he? As an overflowing flood of the river Euphrates, flowing down over them. Now, we have a similar thought here in our lesson, except we have the fulfillment of that rather than a partial fulfillment. Assyria was. Assyria represents these nations that will come down in the last days as an overflowing flood. And they have rejected the real waters that God wants them to have, the sweet waters, the healing waters, the peaceful waters. And so they're going to get flood water. You see, too much water kills, doesn't it? Flood water. And so I think this is what we can see beautiful fulfillment of Isaiah 8. In verse 15, we have another interlude, I should say, a time of blessing, time of talking people. Behold, I come as a thief. Now, this is not the same time as he comes as a thief in 1 Thessalonians 5. That's when he comes to the church. But still, God is there in this aspect as a thief. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keeps his garments, or guards his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. Now, notice the time when this will be, right? Down at the end time. God will still have some people, and these people will be tempted. They'll still be tempted, but God's going to keep them. Blessed are those that keep his garment that God has given him. Without these garments, he'd be naked, and his shame would show. Now, this is kind of a parenthetical thought, because we go right back into that battle in the great day of God in verse 16. And he gathered them together into a place in the Hebrew tongue called Armageddon. Now, this is the only place in the Bible that we have the word Armageddon. And yet, I suppose that everybody knows, talks about it, and hears it spoken of. But the thought here of Armageddon is the chariot of Megiddo. And so, we think about Megiddo. Now, Arma in the Hebrew, the word arm or harm would be the pronunciation of it, would be a mountain or a hill or something that is loomed up, risen high, like a mountain would be. The word Megiddo comes from a word that means to make rendezvous or to meet a meeting place, to join forces at a particular time or particular place. So this is what God has designed, isn't it? He designed a place that all of these forces would make rendezvous together in order to come down into this valley. Now, the valley of Megiddo, the valley of Jezreel, and the valley of Jehoshaphat are approximately the same place. And this is where her battle took place, in the battle of Jezreel. There's a town, maybe I'll put it this way. There's a town called Jezreel, and there is a valley of Jezreel. And this valley extends all the way from the Mediterranean all the way across to Jordan. Beautiful, fertile valley. And then there's another smaller valley that comes down from Lebanon. Usually when Jesus went to Nazareth, he went through this way. Remember the fourth chapter of John, it says that he must need go through Samaria. Samaria was the capital of the 10 tribes. Jezreel was the summer castle or palace of the kings of the 10 tribes. It was an extra palace of there. This was usually the dwelling place of Jezebel at the palace of Jezreel. We all know the story of how Ahab looked out the window and saw this beautiful vineyard, coveted it, wanted it, and Jezebel just went out and got it for him, really, without any. And she did this in the valley of Jezreel. See, that blood was shed. It was a valley of blood. And we'll Roberta, look at that in Hosea 1:4. This valley of Jezreel is called the blood of Jezreel. And it was noted for the shedding of blood. And in that verse, by the way, it mentioned Jehu. Read it for me. I can't quote it. 1:4-5. So this is a prophecy. It had a partial fulfillment at one time, but it has a much greater fulfillment, which we can understand when we see the sin of Jehu. Now, God called Jehu. God chose Jehu to put an end to Ahab's rule, didn't he? But that doesn't mean that Jehu was a good man, not in any measure. God can choose mean people and terrible people to do his will, to do his purpose. People think when you choose a president, they're getting a good man, but you don't know whether God wants a good man in there. He might want a terrible, mean person in there to fulfill his purpose and will. Well, he chose Jehu, and Jehu went down, and I'm not going to turn to that and read it. I'll just tell you the story. But he not only killed the family of Ahab, he killed Jezebel, and I can just see him riding down through there with his chariot. And everybody knew it was Jehu by the way he drove his chariot. It was one of these kids he called Jehu for a while. because of the way he drove. Anyway, and he got up there, he said, "Who's on the Lord's, who's on my side?" And two eunuchs stepped out, and they picked up Jezebel and threw her out the window, didn't they? And the only thing they found left of her was the palm of her hands and her skull, I think, and her feet or something. Can't remember all of the details of it. You can read it. But this was Jehu's slaughter. He took every one of the sons of Ahab and killed them in Jezreel. See, so what I'm saying, this is a place of slaughter, and Hosea calls it the blood of Jezreel. But here we have another terrible man that's going to be running Israel, and we're going to have more blood there than Jehu ever thought of slaying. It's going to be terrible in this valley, Jezreel. And then Joel 3, verses 2 and 12. The same valley is called the Valley of Jehoshaphat. And this is the only place that it's called that. We read here in verse 16, "And he'll gather them into a place called the Valley of Megiddo." And then we read up a little further that all gather them, a whole world, and gather them to battle in verse 14, to the great day of the Lord Almighty. Now listen to what Joel has to say about it. 3 and 2.
"I will also gather all nations and will bring them down into the Valley of Jehoshaphat, and will plead with them there for my people and for my heritage Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations and parted my land."
Now, who's going to gather down there in this valley? Nations. All nations, isn't it? People have asked, well, will the United States be there? Well, the only thing I know to say is it says all nations. But who's going to do this? God's going to do it, isn't he? The nations don't know this. They think they're doing it. They don't know God's doing it. And they think that they're having the will, and I'm sure that the Antichrist and the false prophet will think he's instigating all of this and bringing those nations down. But that isn't what the Bible says. It says that God is doing all of this. And so this brings us now down to the last great battle that will take place on the earth. Then we have the seventh big bowl in verse 17. "It'll be poured out into the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, it is done." The air here has to do with the atmosphere. I think it's Ephesians 2:2 that Satan is called the prince and the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of the disobedient one. So this air has been controlled by Satan. Now it's going to be taken over. No longer will it be controlled. Now, one thing I forgot to mention here in all these are not necessarily in any order. We cover this tribulation period over and over and over again, looking at it in different times, different angles, different positions. And so here we came down to the very end in verse 16. So now we go back to a time when God is in the process of bringing these things to a climax. And so the cleansing of the heavens, it took place in chapter 12, didn't it? When Satan was cast out of the air, which he's a prince and a power of the air. There's a doctrine kind of going around that Jesus left the throne and he's cleansing the heavens now. Well, the heavens isn't going to be cleansed until after the middle of the tribulation. And so, just before the middle of the tribulation, clear myself. But provisionally, you see, it was, wasn't it? When Jesus died on the cross, he used similar words in the 19th chapter of John, verse 20. He said, "It is finished." And provisionally it was finished. And if Israel would have received the Messiah, it would have been finished. And God would have ushered in the kingdom at that time. But they didn't. So now, all the wrath of God poured out upon the earth. At the cross, all the wrath of God was poured out upon his Son. But this is only to those who will believe. Those who reject that wrath will have to bear that wrath of themselves. When this was done, then a voice came out right out of the temple, out of the shrine of God, out of the temple of heaven, from the throne, saying, "It is done." And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was great earthquake, Such is not since men, such as not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. Now there has been earthquakes for a long time. But if you notice that there are more and more as we approach the end of the age. Jesus said in the 24th chapter of Matthew, he talked about there'd be earthquakes. And I mean, by the way, I may mention this before, but I want to speak of it again. The coming of the Lord in Matthew, Mark, and Luke have nothing to do with the coming of the Lord for the church. It always refers to the coming of the Lord to set up his kingdom. I heard somebody make mention of quote the verse the other day along this line referring to the church. When he comes for the church, he's not going to come in the same manner as he's going to come for his kingdom or for it, or to set up his kingdom as a king. But we're living in a time today that we can see the process of going toward this. We can see kind of the outskirts or the shadows of these things. And these things are getting worse all the time as we approach. Somebody might say, oh, well, you're just reading this verse because you read them in a newspaper, have better news coverage. Well, maybe that's God's way of making them worse. I don't know. But to us, they're surely worse, aren't they? But here we read that this is the greatest earthquake that ever was or ever will be. There is a great, such as not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. And so much damage, so much changes is made by an earthquake, isn't it? Level whole cities leveled by earthquake. Well, verse 19, and the great city was divided into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. Now, I can read in here verses 18, 19, 20, and 21 down through here. There are six things that are mentioned concerning the pouring out of this bowl of wrath. And the first one was a great earthquake. The second one is the great city was divided into three parts. Now the question we might ask is, what is this great city that's being divided? Well, I personally believe, as we read further, well, we have identification with the cities of the nation. We have identification with Babylon. And my personal thoughts along this line is this great city is the city that we're going to read of in the 18th chapter of Revelation. I don't feel that it's Jerusalem, because we read in the 13th chapter of Zechariah, and I don't know exactly where that is. Who reads next? Jack, you're supposed to read next? All right, look up Zechariah 13:8, and let's see if that isn't. It says the city will be divided, the mountain will be divided, rather, and see if that isn't what I have in mind. I didn't even bring the Old Testament with me. I'm going to have to rely on.
Verse 8, in that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be like David, and the house of David shall be like God, like the angel of the Lord before.
No, look 14:8. See what.
And it shall be in that day that living water shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half of them toward the hundred sea.
Well, I'd have to look it up. But talks about that he'll stand upon the Mount of Olives, and the mount will cleave in two. Somebody find that verse for me? 14:4. All right. Now, the Mount of Olives is just north of Jerusalem. And this talks about two parts. It don't talk about three parts, does it? And so I personally believe that we're talking about that great city, because we're talking about judgment here and the nations coming down and all these things of end-time judgment. And so the great city was divided into three parts. Then the third one is the cities of the nation fell because of great shaking of God's saying. 13th chapter of Hebrews, we read that there was a time when God shook the earth. But there's coming a time when God's going to shake the heaven and the earth, and it's all going to shake. And God's wrath is shaking things up. And so this causes a fall. Then the great Babylon came to remembrance before God to give to her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. Now we'll read this in detail in chapter 18. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. Now can you picture what happens when all the mountains are gone? What happens to them? Well, they have to fill up the valleys, don't they? And so what we're talking about here is having a level land. It's going to be beautiful when God gets through judging things. The high places will be made low. There's a verse in Isaiah along that. I don't know just where it is off the top of my head. High places will be made low. Low places will be made high. The thing that caused all of this that we have, in my opinion, is the deluge. Judgment upon the earth 6,000 years ago from this time, approximately 5,000 years about. Anyway, when the flood, and we read where the waters come up, and the whole system of this world was disrupted, and mountains formed. Now, here we're finding that God is going to bring, after his judgment is over, and all this is going to be leveled off, all the land will be tillable. It'll be a wonderful place to live during the kingdom age. But what's going to do this? It's going to be the shaking of the land, isn't it? Shaking of nations, shaking of cities, destruction of that which God doesn't want, and leaving that which he does want. And verse 21, the sixth thing, and there fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent, somewhere between 80 and 100 pounds. And I don't know, different people have different weights on this. But even if it was 50, it'd be pretty heavy, wouldn't it? We had a hail not too long ago here, and they weren't very big at all and damaged a lot of cars. Think about a hailstone the big of a talent would really destroy. It would be big enough to level mountains, wouldn't it? Think about it. But in all of this, men blaspheme God because of these plagues. The hail or the plagues thereof was exceeding great.